In this house, which was his home, Tom rolled, husband, father, man, through God's mercy by his pen, kept us all in joy from harm.
Sonia Rolt, reading the words she wrote in memory of her husband, LTC Rolt, always known as Tom, that are carved into the gable of their house in the hamlet of Stanley Pontlarge in Gloucestershire. The house dates from 1375, but marks in the great timber beams show they were recycled from an even earlier building. An apt home, then, for an engineer fascinated by skill and craftsmanship. And it was here that he wrote most of the books, at least 35, that were published before his death in 1974.
Tom Rolt was a great writer. He wrote in a very lucid, fascinating, inspiring way, which leads his readers to follow his inspiration and his enthusiasms into canals and railways and engineering history.
His biography of Brunel is a great biography by any standards. It is a terrific evocation of the luminosity of this larger-than-life, although minute, figure, Isambard Kingdom Brunel, and all he achieved.
Narrowboat is the key book for all canal historians, and the revival of interest in canals that came along after the Second World War really all stems from this book. You won't find any true canal enthusiast who hasn't read Narrowboat, so I think it's an absolute standard work and a masterpiece.
Angus Buchanan, a professor of the history of technology, Sir Neil Cozens, former head of the Science Museum and English Heritage, and John Powell, librarian at the Ironbridge Gorge Trust Museum. So LTC Rolt was the author of great books, books that saved our heritage and changed our attitudes to it. How come then, in the year when those in the know are celebrating the centenary of his birth, is he not a household name? I must confess that before I started work on this programme, I'd never heard of Rolt, and I'm a scientist interested in the issues that concerned him. Tom Rolt was born in Chester to genteel parents. He wrote that it was a wonder that spending his childhood in an idyllic pre-industrial landscape, in a family where the men weren't just not technical, but lacking any skills from which they might make a living, he developed a vocation as an engineer. He left school as soon as he could, was apprenticed, and developed a reverence for people with skilled hands and minds.
He loved nothing more than squatting down by some old chaps who made something or had made something. He would sit on his hunkers and yarn away and so on. Yes, that would be a very good time always for him.
I think Tom Rolt was a divided personality in terms of his literary output. He was part engineer, part poet. He was in many ways appalled by what the Industrial Revolution had done to our countryside.
Timothy West, actor, narrowboat owner and Rolt devotee. He wrote the foreword to Rolt's autobiography, The Landscape Trilogy. He's speaking after a Rolt centenary event at the Cheltenham Literary Festival, where he shared a platform with Tim Colan, owner of Braunston, one of the earliest canal depots.
There was something almost schizophrenic about Tom Rolt between his fascination with the Industrial Revolution, which was immensely destructive. His description of Stoke-on-Trent, even in the 1930s, was quite amazing.
The steelworks made a very fair representation of the mouth of hell in some medieval Last Judgment. The works seemed to be perpetually shrouded in a cloud of smoke and steam which fumed or jetted upwards from innumerable chimneys and pipes, a cloud reddened here and there by reflected furnace light. Occasionally a shunting locomotive would labour up to the top of one of the tips, pushing before it a ladle of molten slag. When it reached the summit, for a few moments the tip would resemble a volcano in eruption as the molten stream coursed downward, its vivid glare lighting up the night sky. So this was the heart of the matter. This was what the Industrial Revolution was all about. It excited me, yet at the same time it filled me with a strange sense of apocalyptic foreboding.
But he was also aware that there were beautiful things born out of this destruction.
And we have that at Braunston Marina, where Telford was present and built the bridge across the front entrance of the marina. A very, very beautiful bridge, and it was the first mass-produced cast-iron bridge in the whole world.
And that they could in some way be protected and treated as part of our archaeological world, really.
Standing here on this bridge over the River Dee in North Wales, just a couple of hundred yards upstream of Pont Cysylltu Aqueduct,
Sir Neil Cozens, former head of English Heritage,
brings together so many of the things that I remember about Tom. And in Pont Cysylltu Aqueduct, we have what is the greatest monument to the canal age. It's the work of Thomas Telford and William Jessop. And Tom Rolt wrote a splendid biography of Telford. And in his early days exploring the inland waterways, long before anybody else was doing it for pleasure, his ambition was to take a boat across Pont Cysylltu Aqueduct. And I remember in some of the splendid stories that Tom used to tell, the awe in which he held Telford, specifically as a result of this fantastic structure, the canal in the sky, literally silhouetted against this beautiful autumn sky.
Tom Rolt did his first writings about canals aboard a boat that he had bought as a hull and fitted out himself, a steam-driven narrowboat called Cressy.
While living aboard Cressy with his first wife Angela in the 1940s, Rolt was disheartened by the deterioration and disregard of the canals.
Journeying throughout England, he felt that the entire inland waterways system, which was vast and had largely been closed down by competition from the railways, deserved to be reopened and maintained and looked after.
He battled with broken locks, weed and shallow silted up cuts, but he insisted on his right to navigate, famously forcing the Great Western Railway to replace a new bridge that was too low to allow boats to pass.
They have become an enormous national economic and social benefit, mostly through his agency.
He wrote half a dozen books during this time. But as well as boats, he had another passion, cars. Old cars that you could fettle.
I'm Richard Rolt, the elder son of LTC Rolt, and I'm standing here in front of my grandfather's 1925 Brooklands Alvis, which was owned by my father for the largest part of its life. He inherited it, and now I've inherited it. And I'm just going to open the bonnet and we'll look at what's inside. And I think this car was part of my engineering education, because I am an engineer, and I think I became an engineer with my father explaining how the material world worked. And he would have taken this car as an example and shown me. It's quite obvious what each bit does. I mean, in front of me I've got the engine, which has got four cylinders, and then it's got a carburetor, which is below the manifold, and easy to see. Like, you could adjust it and change it and see what the effects of the adjustments are. And then it's got a very simple radiator with no water pump or anything complicated like that, so it's quite clear what's going on there. Hot water at the top, cold water at the bottom, and siphoning between, so you can understand how that works quickly. And so any piece on the car can be worked on and accessed easily. Right, I'm now going to close the bonnet and start her up, and we'll drive to the factory that I run about 20 minutes away from here in Herefordshire, and we'll see how we go.
We're now 120 feet above the River Dee on the towpath of the Pont Cysylltu Aqueduct. You can get some impression of the extraordinary feat of engineering. And I think the importance of the aqueduct is that for the first time it uses an iron trough, which is an extraordinarily elegant and economical means of carrying a canal across a river valley. You really get some idea of why Tom Rolt wanted to do it. He had several goes. I think on one occasion he was turned back by the weeds, which were like those in the Sargasso Sea. But to be in a boat on the side away from the towpath, you can get this extraordinary
unique experience of being afloat and looking down 120 feet or more into the River Dee over the side of the trough, which is only, what, 6 inches or so, of freeboard.
I'm going to start up now, quite a lot of little adjustments. There's cord ignition. I'm going to turn the ignition on, half advance it, bit of hand throttle, choke, check it's in neutral and push the button. didn't work, it's already riched up. There we go.
At the time Tom Rolt was endeavouring to bring his boat across it, it was little known, but was on the road towards inevitable closure, I think. And it's a tribute to the pioneering work of Rolt and the others that he encouraged, the setting up of the Inland Waterways Association, that canals have really come into their own. There's been a complete renaissance in our appreciation of inland waterways. Today, the two aqueducts at Chirk and this one here at Pontcysylltu are one of the prized destinations for anybody with a narrowboat. This is the great spectacle, such that it's now a World Heritage Site, inscribed on UNESCO's World Heritage List in 2004.
Rolt's commitment to the cause of the canals was paying dividends, and his career as a writer was making progress. But sadly, his first marriage was coming to an end. Angela wanted to roam more widely and went off to join the circus. About this time, Tom met Sonia South. She'd been part of a war effort group like Land Girls, but working on the canals, where they were known disparagingly as idle women.
We were, and it was much, I think, harder to do than Land Girls, speaking as one who did both. I certainly think it was quite hard to do. But some of us were better than others, and I was good because I'd been trained for the stage in the Saint Denis School, the London Theatre Studio, to which all the wonderful people adhered, like Marius Goring and John Kilgood used to come, and they were all quite young in those days. I was incredibly fit, and I could jump down from one level of boat to another level of boat and run along the planks with them kind of slightly bouncing. I used to jump down from the sides of locks to the cabin top below before she left the lock, because when I was married to my boatman, we worked two-handed always. It was extremely hard. You had to do a lot of clever things, sort of jumping just as the lock gate began to close behind.
A clash of personalities led to Tom, a founder member of the Inland Waterways Association and its first secretary, being expelled. Eventually, he and Sonia returned to his family home at Stanley Pontlarge. There, in a narrow office, strangely reminiscent of where he wrote on Cressy, he set to work, keeping his family in joy from harm by his pen.
I'm LTC Rolt's youngest son, Tim. There's two of us, Tim and my brother Richard, and I'm sitting in the room that I remember, well, it was his writing room.
And he was really working hard when we came back into living in this house, which we had 20 years in this house before he died.
He used to give me sixpence to take his letters down to the post. Sixpence to post a letter, or a penny to come up and knock on his door to call him down for a meal.
And down here, small children, they were around and having imaginative games, yes. And he liked, he found it comforting, the clash of saucepans.
And I can remember as a small child coming up the stairs to do that and knocking on this door and then opening the door and there'd be a kind of thick cloud of blue smoke in here from cigarettes. And he would turn and come down after a while.
In a very short time he wrote these books, because he had to. He had to make money, that was the thing.
He had this very big manual typewriter, which you could hear as well around the house, the clacking of the keys. It was a sound from my childhood.
One of the striking things about Tom Rolt was that he did his time as an engineering apprentice. He worked in car stewards in Stoke, in steam locomotive engineering, sentinels in Shrewsbury steam lorries. He got a grounding in everything that was traditional British engineering.
Motoring in cars like this was one of my dad's early interests. He owned a number of cars through the 1920s and 30s, and I think he even then recognised that the cars that were being made into the 1930s had different characteristics than the ones made earlier, and that the characteristics of the ones made earlier, which at that time were being sort of scrapped and disposed of, were worth preserving. And he got together with a bunch of friends of his and founded a thing called the Vintage Sports Car Club. So we've got a truck to deal with, so we'll go very cautiously past this truck.
And of course, he went from job to job because of the Depression. And he saw the hardships of the 30s.
As I passed through the streets of Stoke, I saw many of the men whom I had worked beside, admiring their skill and proud to think of them as my friends, leaning against the walls of street corner pubs or crouched on the steps of terrace houses.
You see in his writings in the 40s and 50s a real understanding that industrial capitalism had brought huge benefits and great prosperity to many people, but great hardships too.
Their faces and hands looked unnaturally white and clean, and their eyes did not appear to focus on anything. There was no work for them. Somehow, I could not bring myself to attract their attention, still less to stop and speak to them, for I felt ashamed.
I think my father loved driving cars like this because he could appreciate them on so many levels. He could understand them, work on them, and then use them, and through using them, understand them more deeply. He could understand the material world and explain it simply, like a poem. And I think that is borne out by how I experience this car. It's easy to understand it. It's easy to see the consequences of my experiments with it, and I can then appreciate the result, a kind of a relationship between us human beings and our material world can be through dexterity and comprehension and intelligence. They're one thing, not separated.
We probably call him an environmentalist today. He had a deep understanding of the value of and sensitivity of the landscape to the impact of man on it, and great anxiety, I think, about the bad and the harmful that should come out of over-exploitation.
He had a supreme sort of love and understanding about things in the most remarkable way. He was born a philosopher, almost, I feel.
And he wrote philosophical works too, such as High Horse Riderless, a critique of unfettered industrialisation, taking its title from a poem by Yeats, whom he revered. Rolt's writing ranged widely. He captured nature, landscape and characters vividly and with wit. And as well as canals, railways, motoring and engineering biographies, there were books on ballooning, ghost stories and ideas. But he remained a practical philosopher.
He and Sonia just ran that little railway in 1952, almost entirely on their own. One was one end and collecting the tickets, and the other was the other end driving the bloody trains. And they were living in a caravan. What a way to start a marriage. I mean, if you want mental cruelty, you just got to tell the judge what he made you do.
Tim Colan is talking about the Tallaght-Lean narrow-gauge railway in North Wales, built to bring slate from the quarry to port in 1865. Rolt loved the ancient track and the original locomotives, almost like a child with a train set. The quarry closed after a rock fall in 1946, but he was determined to keep the railway working. His inspired idea was to use volunteers to run and maintain it.
One of my favourite places to be is at the end of the day, up in the loco shed, seeing the engines come back and seeing the volunteers sort of happy. That's the job satisfaction. They've got up very early in the morning, they've lit the engines up, they've taken the trains out, they've met the public who come back time and time again. He must have had some kind of vision. He must have done. It was something that had to be preserved.
I know he wrote into our constitution quite clearly that no one person should ever be able to take it over and be in charge of it. It had to be a group thing, and that's Tom's legacy very much to us.
Volunteers running the train named after Tom Rolt on the excursion marking the 100th anniversary of his birth. Rolt's scheme involving and empowering volunteers has become a model, and there are projects all over the world run along these lines.
There are now literally hundreds of heritage railways worldwide, and they all stemmed from this starting point, which showed it was possible.
Richard Hope, president of the Tallaght-Lean Railway Association.
The idea that you could, with volunteers, run something as complicated as a public railway carrying passengers for profit.
I think he was astonished by the enormous response that he got from ordinary people who were just saying, yes, this is something we value, this is something we think would be enjoyable. We want to sort of doff our caps to the engineers who actually made this happen, and let's go along to Towan and enjoy it. Tom was one of the first people to realise that it was no good going on as if the government was going to look after everything that we valued. Thank God.
Timothy West. Recently, LTC Rolt's papers have been taken from his house to the Ironbridge Gorge Trust Museum. John Powell is the librarian here, working with, aptly, volunteers to catalogue and conserve the Rolt archive.
It consists of draft manuscripts and typescripts for most of his major books, and also one or two folders of correspondence and so on about the Tallaght-Lean Railway and some of the other projects with which he was involved. And there are one or two gems, and one of those I've got out on the table here for you this afternoon. And this is the original logbook for Cressy. It's a fairly humble-looking exercise book, and he's written it all here in fountain pen. And of course, from this we get the famous book Narrowboat, which he wrote later on. And again, alongside here I've got one of the draft manuscript versions of Narrowboat.
When I awoke, the sunlight reflected by the breeze-ruffled water was weaving patterns of shifting light on the cabin roof, and from without came sounds of manifold activity. There was a clinking of hammer on anvil, the creak and sigh of forge bellows, and the clatter of corking mallets. I looked out to see two cart horses outside the door of the smithy, awaiting their turn to be shod, and men at work on the narrowboat in the dry dock.
Here in the centre of Ironbridge, you can get some idea of the origins of the Industrial Revolution, standing on the bridge as we are now, and nearby is Cobourt Dale, where iron was first smelted using coke as a fuel, and the original blast furnace is there. The world's first iron bridge from 1779, and it's still very powerfully expressive of this 18th, early 19th century period in which Britain becomes the world's first industrial nation. And it was an area that Tom Rolt knew well and had huge affection for the place, and his memories of it were of its very rundown and melancholy state before anybody had recognised it as the important place that it is.
The important thing about Tom Rolt is that he did see and highlight the importance of our industrial landscapes, the way human intervention gives place significance and even beauty. Angus Buchanan, Emeritus Professor of the History of Technology at Bath University, has found a single place that perfectly encapsulates Rolt's interests.
The three great interests of Tom Rolt, which are summed up in the position we are in the middle of Sydney Gardens in Bath, the canals, where the Kennet and Avon Canal was constructed right through the park, completed in 1810. It had become absolutely obsolete and unworkable by the 1940s, and Tom Rolt was one of those who backed the Kennet and Avon Canal Trust, which set about its revival. And it is now open throughout and is flourishing. So that's the canal. The second of the great things here is the railway. The local opinion was already miffed at having had the Kennet and Avon Canal go through the park, and now here was the railway. But Brunel's solution to this was to treat it as a theatrical event, not to shut the railway away in a tunnel, but to present it. So in the middle of the park, you can come down to where we are standing. You can come down to where we are standing, and the trains appear out of the wings on one side of the stage, and they disappear into the wings on the other side. It's all set out like for a public display. Those seats are arranged for people to watch the trains go by. And this was what people did, undoubtedly. But specifically, it was the Great Western Railway. It was Brunel's railway. And this is the third point that Tom Rolt became the outstanding biographer of Brunel.
Tom Rolt understood the aesthetics of engineering and the engineering of aesthetics. And in that sense, was one of the pioneers of what we might today call industrial archaeology, long before the term was invented in the mid-50s.
Tom Rolt was a pioneer in many ways. He educated us in how to look at industrial landscapes. He recognised the importance of the canals and saved them. He understood how to tap the enthusiasm of people and created a model of volunteering of global significance. And then there's his writing. All those books, many still in print, on a staggering array of subjects. So now, in his centenary year, is it not time for LTC Rolt to be recognised, not just by narrowboat owners, railway buffs and engineering enthusiasts, but by everyone who appreciates the work of mind and hand? LTC Rolt. This should be a household name.
It was all related together. It was some glorious sort of whole that he was risking everything to kind of love and try and understand and stick it all together. And that's how he lived, I think, really.
My father helped preserve the Tarrytown Railway along with many others. And in 1965, they celebrated the centenary of the railway with a special service of thanksgiving in Towyn. And the Reverend Audrey, the writer of the Thomas the Tank Engine books, asked my father to read a lesson from Ecclesiasticus chapter 38. After describing the work of different craftsmen, the ploughman, the smith and the potter, it concludes as follows. All these put their trust in their hands, and each becometh wise in his own work. Without these shall not a city be inhabited, and men shall not sojourn, nor walk up and down therein. They shall not be sought for in the council of the people, and in the assembly they shall not mount on high, but they will maintain the fabric of the world, and in the handiwork of their craft is their prayer. He then concludes, and in such magnificent language do these words express my own belief that I found myself profoundly moved, so much so that I could scarcely get the words out of my mouth, and I nearly made a fool of myself in consequence. And reading this in his autobiography, in my own factory, I feel much the same way.